Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Indoctrinate Yourself. Today, I'm joined by the incredible James Lee, who's an investigative, independent journalist, also a contributor to Breaking Points. And funnily enough, we ran into each other at Rescue the Republic in DC like a month ago or so at this point. And he interviewed me on light and mitochondria because I was wearing my shirt, Make Mitochondria Great Again. And so we had this great interaction. I went home. I was on X, kind of just like putzing around, and I found somebody who had this incredible post, and turns out it was James, but I gave him a follow from that, not realizing that this was the same person I had just spoken to. And so, in this like twist of fate, I feel like our worlds are meant to collide. And I'm really excited to chat with you today. I think you just have a wealth of information to offer people, and I'm really excited to learn about how you got into this work and how everything's going post-election, because it's November 11th right now. The last week has been pretty crazy, and so I'm excited to get into that with you as well.
It was so nice to kind of connect on in person, but then later on realize, oh yeah, that's also the same person. That's always a fun serendipitous thing. And I would say, that's a good, thank you for that intro. I would say, there's things that I research, things that I look into, but I am by no means sort of the arbiter of truth when it comes to any issue. I'm a curious guy, so I just try to research things online, and then I basically tell people what I've found out. And then I always try to encourage other people to do the same thing and to fact check me and do all kinds of stuff. So I think that's kind of the new era of media that we're in. And I think a lot of it is good, probably a little some downside there too, but it's just encouraging people to take ownership of information versus just being fed information and then internalizing it without doing, your own due diligence.
Totally. And I mean, I think that's a really valid point. We're kind of seeing this bifurcation where if we look at like the traditional news media, that's kind of this failing industry right now that people don't really have trust in anymore, especially post-COVID, and like how just it's been really exposed as propaganda for the most part. And then we have like simultaneously, we have this emergence of like TikTok and short form content that's like really gripping the younger populations. But at the same time, we have this burst of long form content like Rogan's podcast has become so popular, and people want to hear full fleshed out stories and explanations. They don't necessarily want these quick sound bites. And so I think it's like a really interesting time to be alive, especially in the world of like, let's say, journalism, where it's like on one hand, people want the quick bits, but on the other hand, actually, a larger subset of people perhaps want some more nuance and detail and want to be able to kind of make up their minds for themselves. So I think it's a really important time to have people like you in journalism because there is this thirst and hunger for higher quality information and more nuanced information.
Absolutely. I think that's, I mean, that's kind of the big fear in mainstream media right now. I think just talking about the election a little bit, this is like the first real sign that the mainstream media does not have the same amount of power in terms of controlling the narrative. As you could see, one candidate got, just an exorbitant number of Hollywood endorsements that didn't make any difference. And one candidate was smeared all over the media as some, as a fascist, a Nazi, whatever they like to call Trump. It didn't work. The American media did, or the American people didn't buy what the media was selling, because now there's such a powerful ecosystem of alternative new media that people are just getting their information elsewhere. So maybe they're not even hearing those those messages, or those messages are being effectively combated with other information, which is what I think free speech is all about, right? Free, the journey to truth shouldn't be, closing off certain avenues of finding out information. It's just be, hey, I have information, you have information, let's go to battle. If you believe what you're saying, okay, let's talk about it and then see, which side wins versus censorship, which, by the way, can only serve the means of the people who are already in power, because only those people have the ability to censor it all.
Totally. And I mean, we really saw that in full blaze during COVID, and like Zuck coming out after the fact more recently saying, like, hey, we got pressure from the White House, et cetera, to not let this content be live, whether it's the Biden laptop or, vaccine misinformation or like the lab leak hypothesis and all these things that were considered misinformation at the time that have slowly come to light that actually, this is probably the prevailing theory now, and everybody's kind of in agreement on that. And I mean, that just points to the importance of, if anything is going to be deemed as misinformation, like who are the people that are deciding what's misinformation? Because that's going to dictate what information actually gets out to people. And so I think still on Instagram, that ecosystem, even though I've built my business on there and I've like forged so many beautiful connections and met clients and students on there, but like the censorship aspect on Instagram is just brutal, with the fact that like these shadow bans that they still don't admit are real. Like you could just be doxxed, like all of your engagement just tanks because you're, you know, maybe tagging the wrong people or saying the wrong things. And it's just a real shame on it, that I hope we can kind of make some progress there in the next few years, because I mean, Twitter and or X rather is emerging as this major platform where people can actually speak their truth. And so I think, is that like where you're primarily active, or are you also active elsewhere?
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the censorship on Instagram, and I was about to interject. Have you tried using TikTok? Because TikTok is probably, in my experience, the most censorious because of the fact that they're on the verge of being banned, right? They're right now they're going through the court system. I mean, the law is already, or the bill is already passed, and now they're just fighting the through the court system. But that's where I've found the most censorship, because they're much more quick triggered when it comes to like taking down videos, censoring videos, demonetizing videos, you know, killing accounts. That's much more, in my experience, that's much more common actually on TikTok versus Instagram. Instagram, it almost seems like they're taking a more manual approach to the, sometimes to say like, oh yeah, you're kind of small, so we're not going to deal with you right now. But like once you reach a certain size, then that's where they start to kick in. That's what I've noticed. But in terms of like where I am, I'm basically, because of, you don't know what's going to happen, right, with social media and the different regimes of social media, I am very diversified, or I'm trying to be as diversified as possible. My biggest account is on TikTok, which is kind of where I got the most traction initially before TikTok became not TikTok anymore. And but I'm also on Instagram, which is a more recent thing for me, because I was like, I'm just going to post everywhere just in case. And also on X, which is probably where, honestly, it's the most freeing place to communicate information, because sometimes on the other platforms, I have to be a little bit more obtuse and like use euphemisms and this and that to try to skirt algorithmic suppression. Whereas on X, I can just say directly what I mean. But I'm also on YouTube as well. And that's where I produce some more longer forms. So I'm both in like short form, where it's like 1 to 3 minute videos, versus YouTube, maybe 10, 15, 20 minute videos, where I'm taking like a deeper dive, more of a mini documentary style into a certain subject. So I'm all over the place, because I think, you know, you kind of need to be, just because you don't know what's going to happen, right? One day some new person could come in to YouTube and change up the whole thing, demonetize, and then you're like, if you're just on there, then you're kind of screwed, versus if you're everywhere, it's really hard, or it's harder for them to contain you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I feel like the community notes kind of compromise on X is a really good one. I feel like that should be actually just across the board used, versus these like nebulous fact-checking organizations where like I'll get fact-checked on something, I'm like, wait, I got my PhD and like I can talk about this stuff, like I'm actually speaking from an informed perspective, but some nebulous expert from a fact-checking organization is like, no, this is like lacking context or whatever. So I think the community knows,
you know, the thing about the fact-checking, I looked into a fact-checking recently from a big fact-checker, AFP, it's like the French press.
Okay.
And there was a whole like scandal that nobody really talked about, but I looked into it. They were basically, from internally, they were investigated, and to do the fact checking, they basically had, you know, they're like 10 minutes per fact check. They get paid $2.50. These people who are doing the fact checking, $2.50 per fact check, and 10 minutes to do a single fact check. And they're all paid by, you know, Google and all these big tech companies. And so then there becomes, then that's where I look into, that's where like I'm most fascinated by, is like the conflict of interest. It's like, okay, so are you actually an independent fact checker if you're just being paid by these platforms to fact check? And these platforms, as you know, a lot of these content moderation teams are very strongly, if not directly, tied to intelligence agencies. One example is Meta. A lot of the people on their content moderation team are like former CIA people. They're loud and proud about it. You just go on LinkedIn and it just says, oh yeah, former CIA, not even hiding it. So I don't know how many people are paying attention to that kind of stuff, but it does kind of align with, you know, how people try to, or how these agencies for many, many years and decades have tried to control information flow, except now it's just a little bit more transparent, because I think people are looking into it.
Yeah. We're at a really interesting place societally with the information age kind of in full blast, because I mean, I think up until this point, up until the past few years maybe even, it was much easier to hide information from the general public just because you controlled the narratives and the stream of information that was reaching them through certain news outlets. But now, with people being able to access information at unprecedented levels, it's really hard to contain that. And so I think we're kind of at this precipice now where we see people like John Kerry saying that, you know, the First Amendment is standing in the way of the ability to rule over the people, and that we need to, you know, censor, and Hillary Clinton saying the same thing, that like we need to control the information as a way to rule over the people. And it's just like, what is this dystopian reality?
It really, yeah, it's kind of, they're just trying to, I guess it's where the means justify the ends. But then when you get into that line of thinking, you start to be able to justify all kinds of heinous things, not just censorship, but all kinds, you know, killing people and doing, you know, for me, it's like, oh, you know, we have to do this, you know, for example, we have to do this genocide because it's going to be good for security, you know, and that kind of thing, where it gets darker and darker. You know what I mean? It's like you start to be able to put the, you know, you start to be able to do stuff where normal humans would be like, that is just, no, I don't want to do that. Right. Just saying, you know, in the United States, you're basically saying you don't want the Constitution is not the Constitution. It's not that important. Really, we can sacrifice the Constitution for quote unquote democracy, which is kind of like a contradiction if you just think about it.
Absolutely. But, absolutely. So I was just going to say, maybe we can dive into how you got into this line of work, because I mean, I think it's great. You're a super curious person. I'm a very curious person. I went the science route. You went the journalism route. And there's a lot of overlap too, but I think between being a good journalist and being a good scientist, and we see a lot of scientists today are not actually scientists. They're more like technologists and propagandists themselves. So that's been very discouraging for me to see from the inside. And also after like leaving academia, like reflecting on the behaviors and just the way that academia is structured as this kind of this bias generating machine for the pharmaceutical industrial complex, let's say. But let's hear about how you got into this line of work and what's motivated you to get to the point where you're at right now.
Yeah. Before I get to talking about myself, I do want to say that you're definitely, like, to me, when I was talking to you at the Rescue the Republic rally, I'm like, oh, this person is like super interesting because you come from that scientific space, but then you're willing to also go against, you know, the cultural norms within that community, which is also, you know, it's a very courageous thing to do, because I'm sure people will frown on you and say like, oh, you're causing all kinds of distress to the entire world, blah, blah, blah.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. That's awesome. So, at some point in the future, where I'm going to, you know, circle back to doing a profile on you. But in terms of myself, I did not mean to get into journalism. That was not my intent. I actually come from, well, I come from a kind of a non-traditional background into a traditional background, in the sense that I went to business school. I went to New York University. It's considered one of the top business schools. I got an MBA, and I worked in management consulting for 4.5, almost 5 years. So I was doing consulting work for Fortune 500 companies, mostly, honestly, in the pharmaceutical space. Actually, most of my clients were big pharma companies. And so I have a little bit of insight, you know, pre-COVID and also during COVID, of what was going on in there. But it was through that journey, I think COVID really woke me up. There was like a couple of awakenings I had. First, it was kind of the Bernie Sanders 2016 run. That's where my activation in politics came about, when I saw how his campaign was entirely just, you know, smeared and completely destroyed by the Democratic Party, who didn't want him to be the candidate. And I'm like, oh, wow. That's when first awakening to there's something wrong with the Democrats, because I had always been kind of a Democrat growing up, as taught as that's kind of the good party. That woke me in that space. And then COVID was my second awakening, along with many other people, right, in America, where we saw public health figures make decisions, hide information that was not in, you know, in pursuant to public, actual real public health, right? They were hiding information, they were obfuscating facts, and they were just trying to more or less, you know, control people's behavior. And I saw that, and I kind of saw that within the own work that I was doing. I'm like, hey, I'm doing work that's basically like gutting America from the inside out, you know, basically taking these approaches where we're going into a certain company and we're seeing where the quote unquote efficiencies are, and we're exploiting it, and we're decimating communities all throughout America. One of the cool parts about the job that I was doing was I got to travel to all kinds of small towns and met a lot of, talked to a lot of different types of people, and met, just a diverse perspective. I just saw a more diverse perspective than what I got, in New York City or in Los Angeles. And then I realized, wow, this is, if I continue to do this work, I'm going to be contributing to this mess. And so one of the blessings of COVID is that I got to be at home, because before that I was traveling. I think in 2019, I spent like 200 days on the road, just in
Wow.
hotels, just going to different, being at the client's side and everything like that. And COVID, I was at home. I was no longer traveling because it was shut down. And so then I was just doing the work versus like the fun aspect of traveling around. I don't know if you, how much you know about the consulting world, but it's a lot of it is like kind of glossing over the work and just like, oh yeah, we're gonna go out to dinner at this place and we're gonna stay at this hotel, blah, blah, blah. It's that's where you kind of lose your, you self-aggrandize, like, oh, I'm really important and this and that. But then when I was just doing the work, I'm like, oh, this is horrible. And that's when I just started posting videos on YouTube and talking about, just kind of my first dive into just exploring different topics. And now looking back on some of those videos, I'm like, oh wow, this is like extremely surface level stuff. I'm even embarrassed that this is online, but it was a part of a journey to discover things, right? But it was just a very public way to do it. And I just continued to do it until I just then I decided I couldn't do the consulting work anymore. And now more or less I'm diving into this, full time, just trying to find out, it's like a journey to gain knowledge, to find truth, but also to share that with the world and hopefully inspire. And, part of my thing is like trying to inspire other people to do the same thing, just not rely on other people to just feed you information, but seek out information for yourself. And also, even if it's a person you really like, let's say they really like your work. I would say, okay, take the information that you've given and then, fact checker, go down other avenues and then come back and be like, hey, I, totally agree with like 80, 90% of what you said, but have you thought about this? And that's when a lot of things have happened when people respond to me in the comments. It's like, hey, that's, I agree with you mostly, but then have you looked into this? And I'm like, oh fuck, I didn't look into that. Sorry for cussing. But
You can guess.
yeah. And so then that's where, you go down all these rabbit holes. And that's why I think looking back 4 years now, I'm like, oh, that stuff was what I was putting out was so surface level. But you have to go down this journey and hope other people do it too. So that's
Yeah,
kind of a little bit of a
love that.
summary and about, my journey into doing this work.
That's awesome. Very organic transition. And honestly, COVID was like a huge awakening for so many people. In that way, it was a major blessing. I think there was, I mean, obviously negatives to it, but also net positive effects, I would say, overall on our awakening and, like, let's say the evolution of our consciousness as a population, or maybe even globally as well. So also with regards to Bernie Sanders, I feel like, it was pretty insane that they thought they could get away with that, because he was clearly the popular vote there. Like, he would have been chosen as the candidate and got smeared and then kind of cast away. And then the same thing happened again with Bobby
Yeah.
as, the candidate. So it's like, how, like, this is happening very publicly. I don't know why they think they can just do that and, like, at the same time call themselves the party of, like, democracy, and, like, that Trump is the anti-democratic one, when they're literally not even holding a primary because they don't want the popular choice, let's say, to be chosen as their candidate. So it's, there's just so many contradictions at play there. But I think, I mean, we
And they're kind of,
like,
I think they're kind of reaping what they sowed
yeah,
now, because it
totally.
has become a party of no idea, no coalition. They're because they couldn't speak to any of the voters, and they got into all of this kind of shenanigans, I call it shenanigans, and therefore nobody likes them. Nobody wants to vote for them. There's the candidate was never voted for, and they thought it was a great idea, and they were convinced, I think internally, that it was a great idea. And I think it's going to take them a while if, not, and it depends on how well, because for me, supporting Trump, I've never been a big Trump fan, but at least I appreciated his willingness to talk to people and at least go on, and have conversations with Americans, and whether or not he was lying to them or not, I don't know. But if he does an actual half decent job in this administration, it'd be hard to fathom how the Democrats could win another election for basically a generation, because it was just such a disaster. In my opinion, this is just, these are all opinions, but it was just, to me, as a person who grew up a Democrat, it completely, the party is not at all what it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was actually raised in a Republican household, and then in college, I had my little rebellion phase where it's like, no, I'm a Democrat or whatever. And like, it's just kind of this groupthink aspect. And also academia is just completely permeated with this stuff. It's like, I actually have friends who were texting me from campus saying, because I made a post, so there's this like publication on campus called the Daily Princetonian, and they made a post about like, 80% of campus is Kamala support or whatever. And I commented, I was like, you know, basically no surprise there, because it's like all indoctrination, and nobody else feels comfortable to speak up because they'll literally get bullied. And I had people reach out to me from that comment being like, hey, yeah, like I'm like voting for Trump this election. I literally feel scared to like speak my mind, and I'm like in political science or I'm in sociology, and it's just completely captured. And it's just like, what a shame from an academia perspective. Like, that's supposed to be the place where ideas are shared and like the best ideas rise to the top. And that's not happening whatsoever, because people who are right leaning or just not left leaning can't actually speak up because they're afraid of retaliation and like overt harm to their personal, like their life or their physical body even. Like, I just think it's very immature the way that people on the left have been handling themselves and conducting themselves over the past, I don't know, maybe 8 years or something like this. It's just gotten worse and worse, the division and just like the demonization of others, essentially. It's like this concept that anybody who doesn't agree with you is automatically like evil in some way. And actually, this reminds me, I was listening to Tim Dillon's episode on Rogan's podcast yesterday, and he brought up a really, really good point that was actually something my partner and I had been talking about the day before, which was like, what is actually wrong, let's say, like ideologically speaking, with the Democratic Party right now? And we were thinking about how essentially there's nothing sacred that's considered sacred by the left right now. And so when you cast out culture, like, and you cast out tradition, and you throw away everything, like all the wisdom of the people before you, what are you actually left with? I mean, you're basically left with materialism, and, you know, there's no meaning to anything. And I feel like that's kind of what we're seeing also with people projecting, let's say, religious circuitry in their brain onto things like science or medicine or politics, where it's like there's no belief systems anymore because all of that's been cast out as like silliness or the past. And we want to be forward thinking, but now not realizing that there's like a part of being human that requires some form of spirituality, I think, and that's just completely absent from the left.
Yeah, I have no, I mean, it's funny when you speak of your sort of the academic bubble, because at NYU, there was, I guess, some sort of secret Republicans club that it was like very, very underground. And I only knew about it like very right before I graduated, because I was talking to a couple of the guys who I was friends with, and you know, we were having a real conversation about politics and Trump and yada yada, and I was sharing them some of my thoughts, and they're like, oh man, you're a good dude. Like, basically they're like, oh, you're kind of one of us, kind of, you know. I was like, I don't know if I'm there, but I'm like, I'm open to all kinds of ideas. I was very early on in 2016, I'm like, Trump probably will win this thing, and nobody thought that. And then our whole, you should have, I mean, in 2016, it was nuts when we went to school, because the day after the election, everybody was like, it looked like somebody, you know, everybody's grandma had died on the same day.
Yes.
And professors, they could not conduct class. You know, they weren't in the mood to do class. I'm like, are we not here? Like, we're not here to do the class anymore. And they were just having this like post-mortem of like, oh, what are we going to do now? And I'm just in my head, I didn't say it aloud, but I was like, did you guys not see this coming at all? It was kind of a wild experience. And yeah, now I think it is a party that's just like, they thought, I think, to give them, I guess, some benefit of the doubt, I think they thought that they could build a coalition through this kind of more, you know, social causes combined with liberalism, combined with some never Trump people. Turns out just not that many of those people out there. Right. It's just like when people's material needs are not being met, it's very difficult to say, oh, we need, you know, not to denigrate, you know, trans people or anything like that. But it's just really hard to them to say, oh, that is the most important issue, when inflation is out of control. And people on the Dem, they don't understand inflation in the in the sense that I think normal people understand. They look at the inflation rate and they say, oh, inflation is back to normal. But they're not accounting for the fact that it went up so much in the past 2 years that the prices are like double what it has been. So let's say it's not increasing at that rate anymore. It's still increased double over a very short period of time. And they don't understand that that is still hurting. It's making a difference. And they all just point to, oh, well, the economic indicators are so good. And I don't think they're looking at like data, but not they're not really able to speak to regular people. And the way they try to get their message across isn't to meet, you know, the voters where they're at. It's to kind of shame them into thinking, oh, well, you don't understand the economy. You know, it's just so good. You just don't know how to read the chart. And I'm like,
Yeah,
how is that a good message? How is that effective?
the gaslighting is pretty crazy. I mean, there's a lot of detachment from the real world situations that like 90% of the population is facing, at least like middle America, which, you know, the middle class is like rapidly collapsing. We can't continue on the trajectory we're on. It's like unsustainable. Like between my partner and myself, like up until recently, we had like a 200,000 plus household income and we were living paycheck to paycheck. It's like, what is happening here? Like we both went to Princeton, like we both have great degrees, but it's like the pay isn't keeping up with the rates of inflation and the cost of goods rising. And it just seems insane to gaslight people for that. And I think, again, like there's nothing necessarily wrong with identity politics and all of this stuff, but why are we governing the like 99% of the people over the issues of 1% of the population? I mean, that doesn't mean we shouldn't care about people who have, who are on this on LGBTQ, et cetera, like that they're important too, but we can't impress all of their needs on the whole population because it doesn't apply to most people. And so I think I also think that people on the right, like most people just want to be able to be left alone, like make money to take care of their families. And they want that for everybody. We shouldn't have to cater to a subset of the population because, you know, the cost of eggs is so expensive. And I saw some memes from the left like during the election, like right after, and they were like, glad to see that like trans and women's rights aren't as important as like being able to feed yourself. But actually, like you have to have the baseline needs met in order to care about higher order things like the issues of people that, you know, maybe aren't even in your community. So pretty wild the type
Yeah,
of rhetoric we've seen.
absolutely. And I think that's the part that I think, you know, was is unfortunate the way history has transpired, right? Because I think you know, just looking back at Bernie, I think he had the ability to merge both sides of like he was able to speak in this kind of universalist language where he cared about, you know, the same things as Democrats do now in terms of like making sure that gay people have the right to marry and all the social causes, right? But he did it in a very universalist way versus like in a way where it's very exclusionary. If you notice, a lot of the language on the left is very exclusionary in that we are, you know, we're in this circle, and if you're not, you don't look like that, you cannot even comment on these issues. You don't have the authority to speak on it unless you're in this circle. Versus like I would hark back to maybe more like a Martin Luther King type of approach where it's like, oh no, we're all in this big circle where, you know, big corporations are coming to get us and there's elites that are unelected deciding policy and they're coming for all of us. We're all, it doesn't matter if, like what race you are or, you know, what you look like, we're sort of in that same box versus now it's like, oh, well, you're not black, so you can't speak on this issue, or you're not Asian, you can't speak on that issue. Versus just saying, hey, we're all kind of, you know, we're all just people, and we should be able to make, you know, we should be able to have our voices heard and our needs listened to. And which I think has, you know, like I said, the Republican Party has actually done a decent job of at least going to the voters and then making them feel like they're heard, right? At least Trump is saying, hey, there's a big problem, you know, inflation's a problem, we have wars all over the place. Versus the Democrats are saying, you know, you don't understand the war is really important. We have to do the war, you know, for the good of democracy. So it's just like a different approach that I don't know. I'm not a political strategist, so I'm gonna leave them to figure it out. I'm just gonna be here trying to find information and educate the public. But I'll let the two parties figure out, you know, their path forward. I think, you know, if Trump does a good job, I think he'll. The Republican Party will be set for a long time. The Democrats, their only hope is that Trump doesn't do a good job, or else I think their whole thing is kaput, because I think they're no longer, because I mean, if you look at all the donors, I mean, they're all rich people. There are no working class support. I mean, in the waning days of the election, you know, they're campaigning, instead of campaigning with, you know, a union leader like Sean Fain, they were campaigning with Liz Cheney and you know, warmongers. You know, nobody likes those people. You know, not one single Republican or Democrat is a fan of Liz Cheney. So I don't know how many votes that drove in. It would be curious, you know, in an exit poll to say, okay, did anybody vote for Kamala because of Liz Cheney's endorsement? How many people are out there like that? Is it 1%? Is it 0.5%? I don't know.
Yeah, totally. So speaking of like the war in Ukraine, have you looked into like the bioweapons programs over there as it relates to like our bioweapons programs leaving after the Patriot Act and kind of going overseas to China and Ukraine and like the role that that's playing in our drive to be there right now?
I have not looked into the bioweapons specifically. I do know, obviously, the entire, you know, military industrial complex is pushing that along. But I'd be now that see, this is what I'm probably thinking. I'm talking to you, you're like, hey, have you looked into this? And I'm like, no, I haven't. Now I should. But what do you know about it?
Well, do you know who Dr. Jack Cruz is? I think I might have mentioned him in our interview. Actually, there's a couple podcasts you should listen to of him. He laid out the history of like medical tyranny in the US, starting back in like the 1800s up through present day, in like a 1 4-hour podcast and a 2-hour webinar. And he talks about how in post 9/11 and the Patriot Act rollout, which apparently Patriot Act was like on the floor of the Senate or the House, like for months prior to that. And nobody thought it would be able to pass. And then, of course, 9/11 happens, and then suddenly it gets ushered through. And one of the stipulations of the Patriot Act was that no bioweapons labs could be on US soil. And that apparently from that point on, it was outsourced to specifically Ukraine and in China. And we, of course, saw like the EcoHealth Alliance lab or whatever, the Wuhan funders that resulted in the leaking of the SARS-CoV-2 in 2019 or 2020. So that's kind of how he teed it up. I'm sure that you would be the perfect person to kind of dig into that a little bit more, though, because I think there's a lot of juice to squeeze.
I'm gonna put that in my to-do list for sure.
What are some projects that you've been like that you've worked on recently? How about like around the election? Were you doing some projects related to that coming up to the fifth?
Yeah, that's for the I try to stay honestly, I try to stay out of sort of partisan politics, because that really isn't my interest, because I don't that's not where I think the most value that I can add to the discourse is not talking about like, oh, the Democrats are going to do this for your life, the Republicans are going to do this, and I find that all to be kind of theater, you know, if you look at it, most of them, you know, it's just the when you look at the bills that pass, it's like, oh, a lot of, you know, those bipartisan ones are like, oh, just for war, for, you know, national security. So it's like all of those issues they're totally in agreement on. And then they try to divide people through these kind of cultural issues, which really have no answer. They're cultural, and so people have different opinions about it. And then they leave us kind of fighting about these things. So I try to look into, I think, more universalist type of issues where people I can bring people together. So, you know, I look into a lot of, you know, health things, you know, kind of more consumer advocacy side. I'm like working on a couple of interesting things right now. I know fluoride is a big
Yes.
discussion point recently, and I'm starting to dig into that. I've just recorded a fun piece with someone where they're like kind of like a tampon investigator. So I'm like, oh, I'll learn about that. Yeah, like what's in tampons? Let's go. And so that's on the horizon. And because there's all kinds of like crazy chemicals and synthetic materials, and I'm like, just putting that in the body and it's cool. Turns out it's maybe not so cool. And so yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking into. I also look into a lot of stuff that's related to like foreign policy, Israel, Ukraine type of stuff, and see like, why are we doing the things that we're doing? You know, is it really what they're telling us, or are there other interests that might be fueling the decisions that we're making? And I think everybody, so I try to look at these issues where I think most Americans agree, and we just need to realize that we agree. So then maybe we can bring these to the forefront versus continuing to argue about, you know, kind of unsolvable issues where we just let people kind of live in peace, right? If some group of people, like the guns, let them have the guns. And other people, if you don't want to have a gun, then don't have a gun, right? And I don't think there's any kind of thing that we can really figure out there, but I think everybody's against pollution, right? And so if we can say, hey, these guys are polluting, then I think we can make a lot more progress versus just like continuing to argue about issues and then just letting them sort of pillage the country, without us making a fuss about it. That's kind of my philosophy. Although I know a lot of people don't agree with that philosophy, but that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I mean, the pollution thing kills me because I remember when like climate change first began to be like a topic that was discussed when I was at Princeton, really. It was like really hot topic. And I remember thinking to myself, like, climate change is such a nebulous phrase to use for this issue because if we actually call it what we really care about, which would be pollution, then it becomes really clear like how we're each contributing to the problem, like what action steps can I take to reduce my pollution of the natural environment versus climate change sounds like this just completely depersonalized issue that is like, you can't really control it. Only like the higher ups can do anything about it because it's just this foreboding thing that is also just not very nonspecific as well. And I mean, the more I look into this stuff with regards to also like geoengineering and cloud seeding and stratospheric aerosol injections and how, in the case of SAI, for example, they claim that it's only experimental, not being used, but I found PubMed papers showing that there is a paper trail of it actually being used for years now. And so that's something I think a lot about because, especially like, I think like Helene hitting Asheville and like Western North Carolina was like a very alarming thing that happened. And then I ended up going down the rabbit hole and finding like Operation Storm Fury from 1948. And they basically, there was a hurricane coming into the Gulf and they wanted to see if they could weaken it. Like, I guess it was maybe some version of not HAARP, but one of the departments that deals with geoengineering. And they were basically fucking around with it to see if they could reduce the steam that it had. And they ended up steering it into Georgia and like catastrophizing an entire, like the entire southern area of Georgia. And so that whole program apparently got nixed after that. But like, it's pretty crazy though, because I was posting about this stuff in my stories, just like, news articles and papers. And actually, somebody from Princeton, what was it, atmospheric science program, reached out and they were like, I'm sure, I can tell you certainly that we don't have the ability to manipulate hurricanes in any way. And I was like, well, we actually did something back in 1947. So if we don't think that's been developed in any way, I think that's kind of naive.
I kind of, I'm on the same page there. It's like, do we have the ability to create hurricanes and guide the direction of it entirely? Probably not. I don't think
Yeah,
so.
probably not.
But to say that there's no ability to influence it would be a lie. And it's almost like they don't want the public to know what they have. So therefore they just kind of say, oh yeah, that's just crazy conspiracy, versus just like, hey, just disclose what it is that we can and cannot do. And it's about transparency, right? I think that's why I am totally okay with engaging and looking into conspiracy theories, is because there are so many things that, was a conspiracy theory, and now it's like, oh, that's just a conspiracy. And so I'll look into it. I'm like, is it possible? Maybe there's, the truth is oftentimes like somewhere in between, where it's like, yes, some weird things are happening, maybe not in the way that the conspiracy theories are saying, but it's definitely not the way that it definitely didn't happen the way they're telling us. It's probably somewhere in that middle ground. And I think there's a lot of power in just seeking the truth, because it helps. That's how I think that's how, if I were to think about how does the scientific community, how would they make a comeback from COVID after we've lost faith? It's just like, hey, you just be transparent. And over a long period of time, if you continue just to be transparent with the public about what you know and what you don't know, you'll build credibility again. Versus now, it's like they're just trying to, it's almost like they're trying to simplify the message because they think we're too dumb
Yep.
to understand it or something. And then when they're wrong, they're just like, oh no, it's just you don't understand. Like it's so much damage. It's like, it's the whole thing when I made the video about the food dyes. They're like, oh well, maybe they're right about the food dyes, but then that could lead to a whole bunch of other things that they can question. I'm like, good. They should start questioning. We should start questioning all of these things that we're doing in our food supply and the agriculture and glyphosate and all these things that some I won't name names because I don't want it to come after me again, but some people out there say, oh, it's a low toxicity chemical. I'm like, what do you mean low toxicity? So like every single thing that we eat has this low toxicity chemical. What's the impact of that? Can we just not do that?
Right.
So it's kind of this, I think that's what I'm trying to do, is to maybe prove, you know, because to me, I want people to have a, you know, safe food, and I don't mind. I think institutions are important. I'm not trying to destroy institutions. I'm just trying to make it clear to them that what they're doing is not working. I'm going to expose you until you change your behavior, right? Until you are a scientist that's not getting your research funded by these big ag or big chemical companies, which you know, when you, I'm sure you know, you can design a trial in a way where a certain outcome is going to be predetermined, right? It's based on the way you set up your variables or whatnot.
Yes.
And I'm like, okay, don't do that. It's like, if you take money from, or if you're affiliated with some certain company, you're going to be incentivized to protect them, right? Because that's also protecting yourself, right? That's how you make money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to make it impossible, or just like nuclear, to not have those relationships. I'm trying to incentivize good behavior, because I think, you know, the line or the saying goes, you know, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. So I'm trying to say, hey, that's, you can't have those, like, because people always attack me for saying, oh, you're not even talking about the science. I'm like, I don't need to talk about the science, because I don't know the science. Because if I talk about the science, you'll just say that I'm not a scientist. I don't know what I'm talking about. But I do know incentives, right? I worked in business for long enough to say, having these conflicts of interest will influence the outcome. So just by having that conflict of interest is already, you know, it's corrupting your ability to make good judgment. And so hopefully, you know, I don't know if it's going to change, but that's kind of my theory of change, is to make people within the scientific community, wake up to the fact that what they're doing now is not working, and it's not mm-hmm. serving the people. And there's still an opportunity to do that. And if there's enough of them that say, hey, we're going to band together, we're going to be scientists, that we're not going to take any money, we're going to fund our research in a different way, and so we're going to regain the trust of the people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's exactly why I'm not going to start my light lab until I can do it in a decentralized fashion that I don't require funding from the three-letter agencies, because I saw the rat race and like the hamster wheel of that is when I was at Princeton. Like, literally all of the PIs there, they spend like 90% of their time writing grants from these agencies. They don't have time to mentor their students. They don't have time to really be involved in the lab. So there's a lot of mentorship that goes on between like postdocs and grad students, and the PIs tend to be very hands-off, and they literally are just hyper-fixated on getting more funding all the time. And that's, you know, just not a good way to do science, because then you don't actually have the bandwidth to be able to make, you know, informed decisions, or be able to guide students to be able to think more critically about certain issues. And it just becomes this place where if you're going for your PhD, you basically get handed a project and you already kind of have an idea of what outcome should be happening. And then you may be unconsciously or consciously biasing yourself towards receiving that outcome that will then get you more funding or whatever it is. And I mean, we saw in the case of like Alzheimer's and the plaques, like the plaque formation, all the fraud that was like recently found within the past couple of years within those initial studies that showed that these plaques were causal in Alzheimer's, and they developed drugs and the drugs inhibited plaques and like no outcome benefits. And it's like, okay, we just went on like a 12-year tangent because of falsified data that now is setting us back all of that time. And that's just one example of like how the incentives can dictate the outcomes. And if you want to get a certain result, you know, you will get that, even if you're only subconsciously telling yourself that is what you want. So I think the way that science is structured, it also goes back largely to like the 1940s, 50s, because prior to that, it was all blue sky research, really. Like, you would get funded as an individual, as somebody who's a good thinker, and they would just tell you to take this money and go off and do what you think is interesting, versus now the funding model and the journal model. It's like so corrupt. And actually, funny, Ghislaine Maxwell's dad is the one who started the journal model, where it's like, and it's a pretty crazy industry too, because if you want to publish a paper as like a PI at a major institution, you have to pay to get it published. And if I wanted to publish a paper in Nature as an independent scientist, it would cost me like $12,000. Then, so you have to pay to get your paper published there. The people who review the paper, the peer reviewers, they don't get paid anything. It's all like, you know, pro bono. And so also the schools as themselves have to pay the journals in order to have the journals available to, you know, the students at their school to be able to read. So the journals are just raking in all this money and everybody is like giving it to them willingly. And it's like, what is this model? Like, how did anybody get this approved? How is this a thing right now? And it's majorly corrupting science, because if you can't get your research published in reputable journals and seen by people, then like what good is it really? So we really need to have better ways to publicize science in a way that's far less biased too, because when you're submitting a paper for peer review, you give them a list of the people you think should review your paper, which is weird to begin with. And so there's already some bias built into that. Obviously, just like the kind of the gatekeeping as well with regards to the finances needed to publish at these major journals like Cell Nature Science. So anyway, the whole system needs to be blown up. We need something new.
Yeah, I am curious to hear your take on how do we implement like a decentralized scientific community where, you know, I think we're starting to see journalism figuring that out, right? How do we do decentralized journalism? And there's still a lot of things to be hashed out of like, okay, how do we properly verify sources and make sure that the information we're giving out is true, right? Because right now it's kind of like chaos, which has its own problems. But I'm curious, like, if research shouldn't be funded in that same way of like trying to get to a certain outcome, what are the different funding mechanisms that could potentially be developed where people can go back to doing like what you said, blue sky research? Because the guys that, you know, the penicillins and all that, because they pointed, oh, I was there was some person who commented on Twitter and said, oh, you don't like antibiotics. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure antibiotics were not developed by Big Pharma. I think it was just some scientists who discovered it, not through that channel. And so I'm curious to hear what your take is, like, how do we get back to that?
Yeah, I think we could have a pool of government money available for that. But I think because like the CDC, the NIH, the FDA, they have specific objectives in place where they're like, we want to create new drugs for cancer, or we want to, you know, it's basically we want to create drugs for X. Like, we're not looking to do science that's actually like, why is this happening? Because it opens this can of worms where it's like, now everybody's paychecks are compromised because they've been endorsing these behaviors for so long. And so it's like, as long as those incentive structures are in place within places like FDA to keep, you know, the pesticides on the food and the chemicals in the food or whatever else, and the NIH to keep spending money on and like, you know, developing drugs that they can sell for, you know, millions and billions of dollars. Like, you look at Ozempic and the types of profits they're making from that. It's crazy. Meanwhile, we're just not addressing like, why are people obese? And like, they're literally suggesting 6-year-olds get on Ozempic versus like, why are they getting obese? Like, let's look at the types of foods they're eating. Let's look at their light environment, the fact that they're on screens all day and they never get outside and they're not playing around in nature. And like, we're just completely stripping childhood from children. Like, maybe that could be why they're obese and not because, you know, they're drug deficient. They're not Ozempic deficient. So those incentive structures, because pharma is just like this major pathway for funds to be injected into, and it's kind of like bi-directional too, that needs to be cut off. And I think that's what Bobby is going to try to do to a certain extent when he's, you know, in a position to be able to do that. And I think it's pretty funny, like, over the past week I've seen a lot of backlash from more centralized docs and scientists about like, you know, how Bobby being in this position is like the worst case scenario for science and medicine, and like people supporting fluoride and dyes and pesticides, and like how we need it in order to have food available for the population. And it's like, can we just like take a beat here and realize like what we're even saying right now? I think we need to maybe rethink the way that we're feeding people, because if we're feeding people things that are poisoning them, like, sure, you're keeping them alive acutely, but at what cost? And like, they're just becoming part of this hamster wheel of like the pharmaceutical medical industrial complex, where it's like, you know, you're basically guaranteeing customers in the future, let's say. So I think it's a whole mess, but I think we can have a pot of money that's like not geared towards any one particular outcome. And this also goes back to basic science in general, and Princeton in particular is supposed to be like the best basic science research institute. And even among basic research labs, where it's like, we're not supposed to be looking for translational outcomes. We're just supposed to be exploring for the sake of doing science. And if something happens, that's great. Even the basic labs are now like trying to get into that pot of money from pharma, because it's like, there's so much available there. So I think we really just need to reconstruct and reconfigure the way that money is moving and like what the incentives are in place for, like what outcomes are being desired. Because when we can just get back to being curious and being honest, I think that's when we're going to get the most benefits, societally speaking.
Yeah, that's, I think I'm on the same page, and I'm trying to, this is one of those messages that I'm still trying to craft in how do I convince people to buy into, doing stuff because it's the right thing to do on a long-term scale. Maybe short-term, you're not going to reap those profits immediately, but long-term, you could find something that could be very valuable. But you just don't know. And I think that goes to outside of even the scientific community, the business community, right? How do you incentivize behavior that's good for the long term? And the example that I use is always Boeing, where the company is about to basically, it's, I mean, it's in the verge of collapse, you could say, in terms of at least the quality of the product, because they've incentivized short-term thinking for so long that they're having trouble building airplanes that are, as safe it was as it was before. Because I know at this juncture, our planes shouldn't be getting less safe. It should be getting more safe. And they've done that for, I mean, I analyzed the crash rates for, the previous generation of Boeing planes, and they were much safer than they are now.
Wow.
Just from a statistical basis, they crashed less often. There were fewer deaths. Now there are
My
more deaths.
God.
Except the deaths, there's still not so many deaths that people are freaking out like every day about it, but it's definitely less safe than it was before. And so then how do we incentivize these long-term behaviors, and like what do we want for this country? Because I spend some time, I like talking to people when I travel, outside of the country, and just to get like a different perspective on, if there's things that we can do here that's better in America, or that we can implement here in America to make it a better place. Because I argue or in argument that this is a great place to live and America is awesome. But there's also weaknesses, and it's like, why aren't we not trying to fix those weaknesses that we could take from other countries and say, okay, yeah, well, let's try to make this X behavior, like let's try to expand public transportation, because if people can move about freely, that might boost the economy in the long run, because people are transacting. It's easier for people workers to get around. They might be able to do more work versus now they're spend like 4 hours on a bus, that's very inefficient. What if it's much more efficient? Now they're producing more. And so I don't think people think like that necessarily, or they're not incentivized at the individual level. Like each company is not thinking, they're just trying to maximize for the now. But it actually probably will hurt long term. But that's still like, I'm just thinking a lot, but that's still something that I haven't fully figured out how to communicate that in an effective way to get people to buy into it. Because right now I think we're still stuck on a lot of that like shareholder maximization, and we need to just try to make as much money as possible and not thinking down the road the impact that this could have. And I think, so this is where I'm trying to practice what I preach, and like I'm not gonna shame people for thinking that shareholder maximization is bad, but I'm trying to figure out a message where I can bring more people in and say, hey, this might be even better in the long run. Have you thought about this? Right. I'm not trying to say like, oh yeah, we got to go communism. I don't think that's, if you've seen really real communist places, doesn't really work. So that's not the solution. But it's like, okay, if you want to make money, okay, how can we craft a society that helps you make more money, but in a way where it's sustainable?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is why I think a lot about like the light story first, because when we learn about the effects of like artificial light on our nervous systems, just at, like a basic level, making us more like more sympathetic at just a baseline. So if we're like slightly more sympathetic in that fight or flight state, we're just going to be focused more acutely by default because we're in more of that survival mode that is preventing us from seeing the bigger picture, both literally and figuratively. So when you're in that sympathetic state, it shuts off your peripheral vision, so you literally can't see as much. But figuratively, within your mind, you also can't see as much from your higher mind, like see the long game, versus our ancestors, like we're great at seeing the long game, and planning for like generations ahead, versus now we're like really just trying to survive moment to moment, because I mean there's so many insults to our environment, from like the screens and the artificial energy efficient lights, to the poisons in our food, to a lack of connection to nature and never going outside, and or the chemicals we're exposed to inside. It's like there's so many insults from every direction that our bodies are literally just trying to make it, and we can't think beyond in order to actually see like, oh crap, like we're actually doing these things wrong. We need to change this in order for 2 generations from now to be successful and unhealthy. It's like we're just thinking like day to day, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's I think it'll take like a shift in people's way of thinking. I don't I'm curious because like okay, so there was one time, I don't know if you've heard of the product Apeel, where they're applying this coating to foods to keep
Yes.
them.
The organic foods we're
And
getting is from like Gates, right?
yeah, so I actually had the opportunity to interview one of the founders. She's like the highest scientist within that company. And I mean, I found her to be a good person. And she, I didn't release this interview publicly because like she like broke down mid-interview
Oh,
because, you know, she
shit.
was very curious about what, why I was sort of exposing them in it, because they're like, we're just trying to do good. And I'm like, well, this is the downstream effect that people have, and this is why people don't like what you're doing right now. And I think it's the realization of like, once you take the Bill Gates money, you can't, you're no longer, you've compromised your whatever your original mission was. Like it's incompatible. You can't take that money and also do what you're wanting to do before. And that's kind of the realization what I tried to get across to her is like, you can't, like you can make the money. Like now you're just making money. Like that's what you're doing now. You're no longer trying to help, you know, food sustainability or like food access. Like that's not the point anymore. It's just to monetize this thing. So like I think that was one moment where I realized, okay, these scientists that are so, you know, so-called promoting these big pharma talking points, not necessarily bad people, but they've been in it for so long and they don't understand, you know, like taking the grant money has an impact on your work. You can't, you know, depending on where the grant's coming from, of course, but if you take it from a certain, you know, big pharma, if big pharma funds your obesity research, then the result will be, oh, Ozempic is the way to, is the way to go. And so then I it's part to, back to like I want to treat people as people. Like I understand where the incentives are. It's like you're not a bad person. It's just you can't have both. You know, you just kind of have to choose one, right? It's like I can't both be a good journalist but also seek to have insider access to, you know, high up people, because the incentives are misaligned. Because if they allow, if like the most powerful people allow you to have access to them, that necessarily means that you won't be able to do the story that you want to do, because they wouldn't have give you that access. That access comes with like strings attached, is what I'm saying. And so, you know, you have to figure out, where do you stand? Do you just you do you want to do the good journalism, or do you want the access? Can't have you can't really have both.
And I mean, speaking to that a little bit, before I went to Princeton, I did a gap year and I was at Bristol Myers Squibb for about 10 months. And I was already kind of red pilled. I mean, even since a young age, I was
Yeah.
very against centralized medicine just because it had screwed me over so many times. Like, I literally saw, like, this is not helping me whatsoever. But I was in this gap year and I was like, you know, I'll make some money, which the money also sucked there, so I ended up leaving. But anyways, so I'm there and I have this realization that the people who are working there was in like immunotherapy development for different cancers, and they actually thought that they were like saving the world every day, that they were doing the most important work that was going to save humanity. And it was just like an awakening, because
Yeah.
at some level, I mean, people may think that, you know, they're just in it for the money and they couldn't possibly think that they're doing good, but I mean, people actually do. And it again comes back to this very short-minded thinking where you're like, let's deal with the cancer in a way that, you know, creates more cancer down the line, because like acutely we're going to be helping this person, but like, you know, in 10, 15 years, I mean, at the very least we'll have plausible deniability that this treatment caused that. So like, no issues from a liability standpoint, and acutely we can make them think we're saving their lives. So like, it's a good done deal. But like, on the other hand, we need to think about the chronic implications of everything that we're doing, as you were saying. But I mean, in particular in pharma, it's like there's no consideration of the effects 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. We're really just focused on getting things out the door and into people. And then, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get there, so to speak.
Yeah. I have a friend who he works as like some sort of project manager, or at I don't know what you call this position, but he manages the sales, the business side of one of the allergy drugs. I can't remember which one, like Claritin, one of the allergy drugs. And he's like, oh, I was asking how it's going. He's like, yeah, product is growing. It's great. You know, business is good. And I just said, well, that means that more people are developing allergies. Is that concern you at all? Like, do we want to figure out why that's happening versus just, oh yes, things are going great because more people are buying this drug, this medication. We should maybe start to think about why are people more susceptible to allergies today versus in the past? Like, what's going on here? Same with like Ozempic, right? People are becoming more obese. Why are people becoming more obese versus just saying, oh yeah, business is good?
Yeah, it's very short-minded. I mean, you mentioned the dyes earlier. Do you want to give us a little dive into like what you found when you were doing that story?
So the stuff about the dye, so I always, clarify, I don't know. It's like, I know what the research says, right? The research says that the dyes are, they could be very disruptive in terms of like mental health and all kinds of other endocrine disrupting things. And that's as far as I would understand about the science of it. And of course, the FDA says it's safe, except the FDA has not actually evaluated the safety of that drug since 1971 or 73 or something like that. So I'm like, okay, so at least let's evaluate it again. And I think the point of the food dyes is it's the bigger story of like, why do we use this in the United States? And I think that's the part that's resonated with the most people is that we have a product that's the same thing, the Fruit Loops or whatever, the other one is, that is being sold in other countries with a different formulation that doesn't have the same, they're using other ingredients to dye the food from like natural concentrates and whatnot, which could still, I mean, people are like, oh, those Fruit Loops are also bad for you. I'm like, yeah, probably true. Probably shouldn't be eating those all day. But they have some other formulation of it that's at least a little bit better for you. And why do we sell that? Why do we sell the most toxic version here? And then obviously the toxicity level could be argued. And that's the part where it's like the hang up is that they're having is like, well, no, this is safe. This is there's no study that's been proven or whatever it is. They're like, oh, that's just an animal study that's in mice and that. And it's like, what are we defending? It's like the part where I'm, the loudest is like, what are you exactly defending here? So you're defending the use of food dyes. Why are you defending that? Is there a reason? Why can't we just get rid of it? Because there's no study that says it's good for you. There's no positive health benefits of this particular thing. It just makes the food look more appetizing. And so that's kind of what I found. So like I said, I dabble in the science to kind of show, hey, there is scientific research being done that says that this is possibly bad. Of course, you can find other studies that have been funded by different people that will show that it's okay. None that says it's good, but some say it's okay. Others say it's bad. Like I've heard testimonies of people who I've talked to about food dyes where they said, okay, yeah, my teenagers, young kids, they could see a big difference in behavior when they're consuming those types of foods. And maybe it affects some people, not others. Right. But that's the thing with everything. Some people are fine, some people are not fine. But it's like, are we trying to protect everybody or just, as long as, we can get away with it only because only a few people are suffering. And, as long as we make sure that they don't make a lot of noise, we just push on. And that's kind of, I think that's kind of the story there. I think from the scientific establishment is like, okay, this is food dyes right now. But what if they go after other things that are even potentially more disruptive to the supply chain? What do we do then? And I think that's like the big story with people pushing back on, let's say, fluoride or glyphosate, because that's used in so much, big ag production. It's like, oh, what if we have to totally change up the way we produce food? That could be a huge disruptor, and now we have to invest in a lot more, new equipment. And these are the
Will make
things
new
that, like,
jobs though. What's
the
the
It
problem?
could it could make me jump, but it'll cost money, in capital expenditure. I think because coming from like business school, I know this is how they think, right? This is going to be a big hit, and we don't want to take this hit. If we can avoid this hit, why do we want to do it? Because we're not going to get any benefit from it. And so it's like all about compliance. I remember learning, this is a lesson that I was taught in business strategy. It was like a course that everybody had to take there. And they said at the time it was called CSR, consumer sustainability. Or it's CSR. What does that say? It's like CS, it's like consumer responsibility, basically. And they said that that is doesn't matter. We don't care, other than complying with the law. So as long as we comply with the law, it's fine. Like, we don't care about making things more environmentally safe than what the law requires. And that's what we were taught. We were also taught other things in business school, like, okay, here's what you should do. If unions are making a big fuss, this is the way to bust unions. Here's what you need to do. Here's the blueprint. Like, if you need to train your workers, or you need to train your office workers to do tasks that the factory workers are doing. You know, so we're taught all these kinds of strategies that are from one perspective. And so I kind of understand what they're thinking when they say, oh, well, this would be a huge disruptor, because that's kind of how they think. They don't think in terms of like overall health of the country. They only think right now, what is this going to mean for us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, with regards to like recipe differences, I think one common one a lot of people know is like Coca-Cola. Like if you get Coke from Mexico, it's made with cane sugar, and I think it's like 30% less sweet. And like if you get it here, it's like made with high fructose corn syrup, and it's much more sweet than like anywhere else in the world, because I don't know what they think. Like the American palate is just so desensitized that we need more sweetness in order to actually buy the product. I don't know. It's pretty insane. But that was one example. And with regards to like the effects of food dyes, like you said, I mean, if there's a risk benefit analysis to anything, basically, and there's also, of course, dose response issues too. But if we can make some progress on one front, given the amount of insults we're facing as modern humans, I think we should do it. Because again, this is also something that really bugs me within like the vaccine research space, is that we're giving like kids up to 2 years old, they're getting like 27 vaccines within the first 2 years of their life. All of those vaccines are studied in isolation. We don't study them together. And yet sometimes kids will get 5 vaccines in one doctor's visit. So we haven't actually studied that that's safe. We've only studied individually that, you know, they're safe in most people, even though adverse events do happen. And that's well known. And yet we would prefer to gaslight parents and people who have had adverse events versus actually try to understand like, okay, why are some people more susceptible than others? Like we have quantum computing emerging. Like we can figure that out if we want to, but it starts with like, stop gaslighting people into thinking this isn't the issue and start acknowledging that, yes, we know that all pharmaceutical interventions are going to have some people will die from them. Some people will have very scary, you know, issues that arise from using the products. And we need to figure out why in a subset of people is that happening and, you know, start to do better, more transparent, like you mentioned earlier, science around this, instead of myopically focusing on like, okay, this is helping this many people. But I mean, we have to look at both sides of the coin. If we're being honest, it's going to hurt a certain percent of people too. And especially if you're mandating these things, that's a problem. Like that's medical tyranny. And this is also what Jack talks about with regards to back in like the founding fathers days, Benjamin Rush wanted to put into the Constitution a clause about medical tyranny. And apparently the other forefathers, Jefferson and the rest of them, looked back into history. They couldn't find any examples of it being leveraged. And so they didn't put it in. And meanwhile, we see that actually is the point of leverage that's being used against us as a population today, because it's this hole that hasn't been addressed. And so I think, I mean, I know the constitutional amendment that Jack wrote for El Salvador is in Bobby's hands now. And so hopefully something happens with that. And it makes perfect sense why, given like your perspective about like trying to optimize for the bottom line, that you wouldn't want to have new laws put in place, because like you said, the law is what's going to structure how the companies behave. And so if laws are changing to make things more stringent and more protective over the people, then they're going to be forced to change it accordingly.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines that I've heard is, how we do business is how we do justice, because that drives everything in terms of behavior. And just to give a story about vaccines, is that I told you, I'm going to try to tell the story without revealing too much, because I don't want to get sued. But I was working with one of the major vaccine manufacturers during COVID, not on the development of the drug, but I was a supply chain specialist. And so we were helping them with inventory. And so we did this full scale, like end-to-end inventory analysis of like how much supply they had and projecting it out over the next year. And, you know, our report showed that there were, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. I can't remember the number now, but hundreds of millions of dollars of supply that was not, you know, they didn't have any sales for. And not, you know, maybe like a few weeks later, I'm just like watching CNBC, and you know, the CEO of this company just says, oh, well, we need to do another booster of this vaccine. And at that point, because I was like, I don't know if you saw this report, or I'm sure everybody knew within the company, I'm like, okay, this is starting to sound non-scientific. It's starting to prove that they're making business decisions versus public health decisions, right? When they say we need to take, I mean, it doesn't make any sense why this would even be considered a vaccine. If I'm not going to try to go too deep into this, but I'm not a science guy, but for me, a vaccine is like, it should protect you from a certain disease. But if you have to take it every, 3 to 6 months and it doesn't do it even, then I don't understand how this could be even considered a vaccine. And I had a friend from Europe too. He's like a Swiss guy, and the Swiss are very knowledgeable. I mean, they're big, they're huge, big pharma production. And they're like, vaccines take years to develop.
10 years.
And this thing was developed in like 6 months, even less, because they started doing trials very, very quickly.
Yep.
And he's like, I'm not taking this. This doesn't make any sense. And at that time I wasn't awakened yet. And so I, to be fully disclosed, I was like, okay, yeah, I think we should do it. I was buying in on the message until I was on the inside. I'm like, oh, it doesn't look like it's what it is at all, what they say it is. And so I think the only way to get back to it, like you said, is transparency and changing the incentive structure, or else, it's always going to be sort of an uphill battle. But I guess the good news is that I think more people are bringing attention to this. And so there is change, right? I mean, I couldn't fathom, pre-COVID, if you were talking in this way, I mean, you would be sort of very much an outcast in society. And today, perhaps still an outcast, but there's a lot more people in your community.
Totally. I mean, Andrew Wakefield made a point. He was the one who like first linked autism to vaccines. And he made the point that like before COVID, nobody was really talking about like vaccine injuries and like the potential harms of vaccines. And now like 50% of like around the dinner table, 50% of homes, there's at least a discussion about like, is this shit good or bad? Like, is it harming us? Like, what are the issues here? So it has definitely sparked that conversation. And actually, just to tell a brief story. So when I was at Princeton, I graduated in 2021 December. So when the vaccines rolled out, we were, I was in school. And I remember telling a couple of my peers, like, I don't know how I feel about this because, like, they've had like 6-8 months or whatever to develop it. And, it doesn't seem like enough testing to know like long-term harms. And I literally got shamed for even bringing that up. And then that was like the absolute nail in the coffin for my connection with academia, because I was like, these are people I considered friends and they literally shamed me. And I was like, nobody can be trusted here, basically.
Yeah, it's. And also too, it's like there are people today that still say it was not mandated, but I'm like, it was definitely mandated for a lot of people. I had to get it. Even if I didn't want to get it, I had to get it because I couldn't continue working. Like my job was like, we need to verify your vaccine or else you're no longer going to be able to come to the office.
Yep.
And so then that puts people in a tough spot because if they need to make a living,
threatening their livelihood. Exactly.
So I think, So even I think the soft mandate at the time was like sort of a brilliant move on the part of the government to say like, we're not mandating it. It's the companies that, but the reality is that they're like one and the same, they're all talking to each other. Like, how do we do this? How do we get people to take this? And then they're like, oh, this is the best way to do it. Just, we'll do economic warfare.
Yep. Yep. And it can never happen again. I mean, I think at least we're all on high alert that, and sometimes like people will, cause I'll talk about this topic frequently cause I want to bring it up. Like I went for a walk during the lockdowns and there was caution tape on the playgrounds.
Yeah.
And people are like, why are you still talking about that? I'm like, because this literally cannot happen again. This was like the worst possible thing that could have been done to us as a society. Like we should have been told to be outside as much as possible, not quarantined in homes, like breathing recirculated air and like, with other people. That's just increasing the likelihood of having an infection or like exacerbating respiratory illnesses in general if you're not getting enough of that fresh air and biodiversity to help support your immune system. And obviously the natural aspects of UV light too in reducing viral replication is huge. And so we just literally got the worst advice possible and we're told to follow it lest we, suffer consequences. And we literally cannot let that happen again. It was absolute insanity. And I think people are at least much more aware that that's a possibility now at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't mean to continue to relitigate COVID, but for me, it had a pronounced like psychological effect because I was, I'm living in California. There was much more stringent restrictions here. And I think it still does. And it's like I've worked with like therapists on this personally. Like it actually changed my fear level of just like being around people and going to different places where I didn't used to have that kind of anxiety, but just like by means of like participating and doing what I was told to do for a period of time, it like changed my psychology, like increased the fear level of, of whether it be right or wrong or good or bad fear, but it's definitely changed the way like it, the prescription of the fix might have been worse than the actual disease itself, kind of idea.
Yes.
Where now I'm having your years later, trying to undo some of those things that they were telling us, that like, oh, you need to stay certain, people are dangerous, if you don't go far away from them, they're dangerous. And I'm like, is that really what we want to be, communicating to people over a long period of time? It doesn't seem like it's and also it seems like some of it was, yes, fear driven in the beginning, right? We didn't understand it. I'm totally fine with that. But then after you knew it was wrong, you continued to do it because of certain financial interests, or you didn't want to be wrong, or you wanted to maintain your control. And then you're starting to feed us information that is basically wrong.
I
Right?
also
Because
see,
then, yeah.
yeah. No, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, I was gonna just make a comment on Fauci, which is why I do so much reporting on him and trying to
Good.
say, hey, this is not a good dude. Because even after he knew, let's say, the social distancing didn't have any scientific backing, he continued to push those same policies. Right? Because in the beginning, you're like, you don't know. Okay, fine. Let's do it for a period of time. Let's figure out what the hell is going on here. And then once they figure out, all these studies came out, it's like, okay, that didn't make any difference at all. But then you still have the same policy. Then I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you lying to us now?
Yeah, and he was also he had that quote of like if you're like going against Fauci, you're going against science itself.
That's right. Yeah. And I was with, yeah, I was definitely late to the game, but it was like in 2021 where I started to speak out against Fauci, and that's when I was still working as a consultant. And so I felt there was a bit of distance, and I started, as I was working, this is a story that, I even spoke up. This is not about vaccines or anything, but like part of the work that we were doing was telling this big pharmaceutical company in the US that they should start outsourcing production and this and that because it saves them money. And I kind of like raised my hand in the meeting of pretty high up people. I'm like, do we really want to be outsourcing production of, like, would we really want to be outsourcing like one of the most important capabilities that your company has because it saves a little bit of money now? Like, what if we, need the production? What if we need to, like, we can't just produce everything in China or wherever and hope that works out. It's like we need to have some strength here, right? We can't just like deindustrialize America. That was not well received in that meeting. That was like a big slap on the wrist and probably led to just like my exit from that project. First of all, yeah, that was my exit from that big pharma project because people were like, all right, this is a kind of a loose cannon guy here. We can't have this. But it's just like, when you're in that space, it's like it's sometimes you're like, are these people insane, or do they not know, or are they just afraid to speak out? Like, what's happening here?
I mean, there's definitely a bit of a fear aspect, I think. And I mean, it's pretty crazy. That's one of the major things that Trump was campaigning on, too, that I think is really important that we develop more of the things that we use and that we need here on our own soil, because then we're less interdependent on other nations. Or if like supply chains go down, God forbid, like we at least have an ability to still
Yeah.
access things. It's like it's from a security standpoint, it's like you're basically setting yourself up to have a more consistent and predictable future, which it seems like it makes a ton of sense. So the fact that like the globalists, I mean, makes sense because they're globalists, are pushing for our supply chains to be elsewhere, because then we are dependent on, well, I mean, I guess on the positive side of things, you could see it's like we're one interconnected world and like it's great. But then like a solar flare happens and our grids go down, then what? Like
Right.
it's
And I
really
think
great to be able to
that's
produce things locally.
the global, I don't buy into the globalist propaganda in that they say that it's for the interconnectivity of the world, but then in practice, it's really just because it's cheaper right now to do it like that.
Yeah.
And that's the same when they talk about climate change or like, these kinds of issues where we're polluting. And then instead of just fixing the pollution, they come up with this scheme of like carbon credits where like people are selling, like they're tokenizing forests that already exist, by the way. It's not like they're planting new, they're just tokenizing the carbon that exists, and then they're trading it with one another. And so they're basically making this like money. They're basically making this scheme where now things are worth something, and that's how we solve it. But in essence, like we have the same amount of carbon that's going around, and so like that's not even the solution. So I think a lot of what they sell, the messaging, is not at all what the end goal is, right? The end goal of globalization is not to bring more people together. It's to generate more money in the short term for businesses. The same way climate change is, it's a way to monetize something that wasn't monetizable. Before, there were no tokens for forests. It wasn't, it's not, it was, they're now commodifying it and selling it as a good, you know, virtually, which is what the goal was. There was probably some person on the inside was like, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And then, and now we have all this whole thing versus like, hey, maybe just stop doing the Davos thing every year. You know, that'll have a bigger impact, you know, than whatever the hell you're doing.
Yeah, literally. I mean, it seems pretty insane to focus on carbon when like we're polluting the earth with things that actually can't break down very well. Like we have great systems to deal with carbon dioxide. It's called having plants that do photosynthesis. Yeah. Like they're really good at that. Carbon is not the biggest fish to fry right now. We need to really be thinking about like, what are all like the man-made chemicals that we're spilling into the waters and into the earth that are like killing the soil life and that are polluting the waters of the planet, that's having all of these externalized effects to the commons. Like, why don't we focus on those things? That actually really matters from an ecosystem standpoint. But instead, we're focused on this nebulous carbon issue that is like, how important is it really? We need to, I think we just need to be more honest and transparent in that area. Like, somebody said something about like any science that has the word science in its name, like climate science or atmospheric science, isn't a real science. Political science, it's like not a real science quite.
Right, it's like, it's biology, that's real science.
Exactly.
the thing I want to add to that commentary is that these, like, it's the, remember right before the election, the peanut, the squirrel, that was like a huge thing that was
it made me so sad,
just a travesty, to be honest. Yeah. And then I looked into it, this the New York Department of Conservation, Environmental Conservation, and they somehow thought this, that the squirrel thing, which I admit probably illegal to do, right, not allowed, but there was a different approach to that, and maybe they could be like, okay, how, here's how you could bring your home up to code to be to allow that to exist, versus doing the thing they did, which is to kill the, you know, the squirrel and the raccoon, which is crazy. I mean, and then I looked into them more, and there was 2 years in the city of Brooklyn where there's these toxic chemicals that were being emitted from the soil that was seeping into the canal, the Gowanus Canal there, because of all the new construction, this soil that hadn't been, I guess, that hadn't been disturbed for hundreds of years. And these toxic chemicals were seeping out. And it took them, the same agency, 2 years to notify the public that this was happening, and people in the neighborhood were getting cancer. Like, there's reported cases of like the residents there getting cancer from these toxic chemicals. And I'm like, this is why these agencies need to be gutted, in terms of like, at least, at the very least, reformed, because they're not prioritizing the right thing. Because the reason why they waited 2 years is that, oh, there was a lot of development happening. You know, Kathy Hochul had like these real estate, low income housing and fair housing things that she was trying to develop in that area. And this would like slow that down, because then they would need to stop the build and like figure out what the hell is going on. And so it was like always because of these business interests, they said, oh, well, this will, you know, let's just try to hide this until like we can't hide it anymore. Versus like, oh, let's just go and just kill this dude's squirrel because, you know, somebody called the agency.
And there's like no accountability.
Yeah.
After the fact, like they just pretend it didn't happen, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So then when people, you know, say that, you know, it's bad to gut these institutions, and I'm like, yeah, I think it is, but these institutions aren't doing what they're supposed to do. So at the very least, like, we need to clean house. And from my understanding, RFK Jr., you know, who I agree with a lot of ideas that he has, he's not saying that we just need to get rid of everything. He's like, we need the FDA to do what the FDA is supposed to do. They're supposed to regulate food and drugs. These people are not doing that. You know, there are all kinds of interests. The FDA people are coming from big pharma, or they're coming from big food. They're not at all doing what they're supposed to do. So they got to go. Yeah. So I'm like, yeah, they do have to go.
Yeah. That shouldn't be an unpopular opinion, I think. And I think for the most part, it's not. But the way the media, like CNN, MSNBC, and like the centralized shill scientists and doctors online are framing it as if it's like this major coalition of people. But I think probably the majority of people are in agreement with that.
They are. And that's why they do. That's why in terms of the media, they go with the character assassination route of like, oh, RFK Jr. is a big lunatic. He has the brain worms. He has the bear thing in Central Park, and he has this and that, which is unrelated to his health policy. Like, yes, he's lived a very colorful life. I mean, his, you know, he's part of the Kennedy family. We can't discount that he had, you know, certain privileges where he was able to participate in all this stuff.
And major trauma.
And major trials, like his dad and his uncle was killed before the age of like 12.
By the government.
By the government, by
deep
all,
state,
I mean, the
you want to
deep
call
state,
it.
some say intelligence agencies abroad. There's a lot of theories, but it's
Hopefully we see
certainly,
those files in a couple months.
well, so I think, yeah, that's what I'm saying is like, I think, you know, I think a lot of us are still, you know, even if we're not Trump people, like I want Trump to succeed, you
Yeah,
know,
we should all want
but
that because it's
we
good
should
for
all want
everybody.
that. And we should, and then I'm starting to see that on X, which is a great sign that people are actually scrutinizing his picks. Like people, supporters of Trump are saying, hey, this person coming in has certain ties. Like we're just, we need to put that out. Versus like in the past, people, I think more people would be like, oh, let's just not talk about it. But now I see a lot of Trump supporters saying, hey, we don't want, you know, these neocons in office, or they'll blast. Today I saw a bunch of people blasting Ilie Stefanik because she's like the new ambassador
Well,
to
that
the
too.
UN, and they're like, no, we don't, this is not a good pick. And so I'm glad that people are doing it now, which is like, I think this is like my hope and dream is that people will hold their own side accountable and say, hey, we don't want this guy, you know. At least they're voicing that opinion. And we didn't see that in the past. And it's definitely not tolerated in the Democratic Party, by the way, in terms of like, if you're that's like you're out. Because I think there's a big difference in the philosophy of Democrats and Republicans in that Republicans, because of their ideology, is more individualistic. So they're more willing to do that kind of stuff. Whereas if you step out of line as an establishment Democrat,
You get
it's
cast
you're
out.
just you're cast out. It's not this at all the same vibe going on, which is I think why the Democrats were able to kill Bernie Sanders metaphorically, politically, versus Trump was not a Republican insider. They did not want Trump either in 2016 or in 2020, or in 2024. They tried to run other people like DeSantis, Haley, but there's not that same kind of like top-down party apparatus control. Which is I think it could be a good thing. I think, you know, there's good and bad for everything. You know, we need collectivism, but we also need individualism. And so to demonize one idea over another is, I think, just unproductive.
Yeah, they're definitely both important. I think we can strike a balance too. And I mean, a lot of this comes back to just like our forefathers had a lot of foresight about the state of affairs in the future, which is pretty remarkable when you think about it, like how specific they were in the Constitution and how, like, you know, we're butting up against that now almost as if they predicted this point would come, and like that's why the First Amendment is in place. And it's pretty wild to see that play out.
That's true. That is, if you just go with the Constitution, things actually just work out. The problem comes when people try to subvert the Constitution and pass laws that are antithetical to the document itself, right? They're saying, oh, the First Amendment is there, but we need to be, but in certain cases, the First Amendment is not allowed, or we're allowed to surveil you, or we're allowed to, or even a big issue that I've been looking into is like, the waiving of the Seventh Amendment, which is your right to a jury trial. And there is a lot of cases, if you see with arbitration clauses that you're signing day in and day out, just like going to the grocery store, just going to like this amusement park or signing up for service, you're waiving your right to the Seventh Amendment by doing that. Going to the doctor, right? I had a recent colonoscopy, which I think it was a good thing. People should do colonoscopies for just checking of gut health. And that's because I was dealing with all kinds of gut issues personally, which is like kind of my personal journey to eating better food and stuff like that. But before the surgery, or before I went to see the doctor, there was like an arbitration clause thing, and I went and I was like, do I have to sign this? And they said no. And I'm like, so they will still do it if I don't sign this? And they said yes. And so I didn't sign it, and then I turned around to everybody in the waiting room. I was like, by the way, I don't think anybody should be signing this arbitration agreement. Because you have no, there's no positive benefit for you, so just don't sign this thing.
Oh my
Yeah,
God, that's insane.
because
They try to really sneak things in the fine print.
if something happens to me, let's say, you know, the off chance that something goes wrong, then now I can't sue them anymore. There's no accountability, right? There's all kinds of ways to subvert accountability, and then there's a reason why these amendments are there in the Constitution. And I'm fully fine too. Let's like if we need to, there's ways to amend the Constitution, legally speaking. So let's do that versus all these things where carve outs of like national security or, you know, whatever the reasons they come up with to subvert it.
Side note, the things that kill me about colonoscopies in particular is they're marketed as this thing that's completely harmless. Like, we're just gonna take a look, but you nuke your
Oh
microbiome
no.
every single time
Yeah.
you do a colonoscopy with the prep, because it's literally like anything that flushes fluid through your colon, decimating the microbiome. So it's, okay once in a while, especially if you're actively having issues.
Yeah.
But people going yearly, I don't think that's a good idea from a preventative standpoint. I don't think,
Are people going yearly? Because
yeah,
I
some
felt
people
like pretty
are.
bad for a while after that. I mean, because
Yeah.
I went in and they did find some things in there, which I'm, glad that the polyps were removed or whatnot. But it certainly was not like non-invasive. Like I
Totally.
felt pretty off for
Yeah.
at least a week in terms
Makes
of
sense.
like my gut and like eating, and it just did not feel right. So I believe that so then what is, yeah, so that's like the overall thing of like we need to just, because the reason why people are needing to get colonoscopies younger and younger, because there's an increase in colon cancer
Yeah.
that's caused by all kinds of, weird stuff that's in our food that's disrupting something and
Yeah.
causing issues. But instead of doing that, then we always rely on the healthcare industrial complex, right? This is only good because now more people are getting these surgeries and it costs money, and this is good, versus like we just have to fix it at the source.
Yeah. I mean, also, there's a gut skin axis that's activated by UVB light that, of course, UVB light is increasing vitamin D production, but it's also directly acting to increase gut microbial diversity, which is supporting colon health. But we're not telling people that whatsoever. We're not telling them that, UV light's an essential nutrient. Instead, we're telling them they have to slip, slop, slop sunscreen and wear their sunglasses every time they go outside and causing their issues. I mean, it's just a rabbit hole, but like, and everybody who listens to this podcast
Yeah.
will already know all this, but it's just very frustrating that I hope that we can begin to shed some light on this and at least reverse the incandescent bulb ban, because that is just, it's just the energy efficiency push is just such a sham in so many ways. But incandescent bulbs are the last source of infrared light in the indoor environment, and most people don't have any of them now. And so all your window glass blocks, all infrared light, LED fluorescent bulbs, no infrared light, device screens, no infrared light. And infrared light, you're supposed to be bathed in it all day. Anytime you're outside during the day, you're getting an abundance of near infrared light and infrared light, even if you're in the shade. And so the fact that we're not acknowledging it as this essential nutrient when we know that mitochondria require infrared light to be functioning sufficiently and efficiently is just, it's just insane how far the industry is willing to go. And like the whole energy efficiency push in tech, it's not considering the health implications whatsoever. There's no guidelines with regards to the effects of light on health. And that's what's really missing in the current, the tech development space and the lighting space. There's no health aspect to it, even though we know at this point, we've known for decades that light is a really important aspect of health.
Yeah, that's the part that I was awakened a little bit to when I came up to you, obviously, because I saw your shirt. So I don't
Yeah.
know what that, I don't know what that means, but I want to find out what that means. And so I think there's more to discover. I think there's, I mean, when we talk about people, with the sun and sunscreen, there's obviously very opposing views on that. But I don't know for sure if the science, quote unquote, is settled. And so to say blanketly, oh, something to be true. That's the part where if somebody's like too overconfident about something, I'm like, I don't know if that's, that's probably should be scrutinized more, right? Because
Yeah.
that's all I always present. It's like, hey, I'm just giving you information. I don't, this is what I know so far. But it's, you should scrutinize me 100%. Like it's, the person who says like, oh, this is 100% fact is probably wrong.
Totally. I mean, especially when it comes to anything that, like, there's nothing that's all bad, really. There's
Yeah.
always a risk-benefit situation going on. And the problem with the centralized narrative around the sun is, like, it's marketed as all bad. And that can never be true. And we also have decades worth of literature to show that there's major benefits. Actually, you're protected against cardiovascular disease and neurodegeneration and multiple cancer types, including colon, breast, prostate, and blood cancers. And your risk for increased skin cancer really only happens if you're frying yourself regularly, which nobody needs to do that. Sunburn is not inevitable. And so there's so much more to the story that's just not discussed. And that's what really gets me going, because it's like, I was lied to about this for years, and then when I actually looked into it myself, I'm like, wow, there's a ton of science in this area, just nobody's talking about it.
Yeah, so I think that's there's a lot. I mean, there's a never ending. That's the, to kind of wrap the conversation, there's so much information out there, and part of my journey is just like, hey, well, let's And that's the beauty of like decentralized journalism, is because everybody has their interest, right? Not everybody's interested in everything, but if we have enough people looking into different things, that's how we're going to acquire knowledge. Versus, I think the more centralized model of information is, these are the things that you should care about, these are the things that we don't care about, and those things are never talked about. But here now we have distribution paths for people who talk about things that, you know, that wouldn't have been covered before. And now people are doing it. And there's a path to, let's say, sustainability, or at least be able to make a living doing it. And I think that's going to be a cool thing to see. Just because now we have, you know, you can go online and you can find people talking about anything and doing research on just about every topic. And that's so cool, because before it was like whatever the New York Times cared about, that was it, or mm-hmm. whatever the newspapers, right? It's like, oh, we don't care about this thing, we're not going to even cover it. And mm-hmm. now they're not choosing what is important. I heard, speaking of Tim Dillon, I was listening to one of his, he's so funny, by the way.
I love
he's
him.
Also, oh, like, yeah, he's funny, but he's also making like good points at the
he
same time.
He does, yeah. It's great.
And he was saying that Hollywood and sort of the controlled media, they don't have the same sway in terms of the discourse, of controlling the discourse anymore, because by the time Hollywood has made some certain movie or some documentary, like there's been 10 YouTube videos made about it already, right? Because I can produce YouTube videos much faster. I could probably do it in a week or two, whereas Hollywood, it takes them like 6 months to do something, or even more, like a year, 2 years, right? Yep. By the time they've made their Boeing documentary, I already know all about the Boeing thing because I've done 4 videos about it. And that's what people are consuming now. And that's like, that was like a very positive thing for me to hear. I'm like, oh yes, things are changing, right? They won't have this kind of control forever. And mm-hmm. now more people are, like I said, looking into whatever topic they want to look into, and people, there's an audience for it. Because, you know, it may not be the biggest audience for it, but there's something for everybody. And that's what's great about the new journalism, is like people can just do it. They don't mm-hmm. need permission. Just look into it.
Yeah, it's awesome. So what can people expect to learn from you recently? I mean, Dr. Stacey Whitman told me to say hi to you. She said you're going to be on some fluoride stuff, which is awesome. But where can people like keep track of you? You said you're mostly active on X and TikTok, or other places as well?
Yeah, I'm active on basically every social media platform. My handle is exactly the same. It's 5149-5149 James Lee, Lee spelled L-I. It's the same on every platform. I'm on X, as well as TikTok and Instagram. Those are where you can find more of like my short form content, 1 to 3 minutes, just kind of digging into something that I find interesting. And then YouTube is where I post longer form stuff that are 10 minutes plus, looking at whatever issue it might be. Like I said, I will definitely be looking into fluoride. I'm looking into, I have videos planned on the TikTok ban, like what's going on with that, and deep diving. You know, why do we have this ban in place? Is it national security, or maybe some other potential reasons for that? So I'll be digging into that. Like I said, shared earlier, I have a collab working on, you know, women's hygienic products, which I learned, because that's like the kind of guy I am. It's like, even if I'm never going to use one of these products, I'm like, okay, this is fascinating to me. And we're like breaking down like the absorption. We're doing experiments of like, oh, this is like a completely synthetic tampon versus a cotton tampon, and like the absorption is like completely different. Wow. Even though the companies will tell you, and this is, I just learned this the other day, the companies will do the thing where they show on commercial that it like sucks up all the water really quickly, and they said, oh, the absorption has been completely the same, because they've been slowly reformulating the ingredients and the materials to make them cheaper and mm-hmm. yada yada, and they're saying, oh no, it just works just as effectively. But it actually doesn't, because they only test it with water versus like, you know, the versus liquid that's like more closer to the viscosity of blood.
Yeah, makes sense.
And so it actually doesn't work as good. And I found that to be crazy.
That is crazy.
So that's me. So it's really just doing stories that I find to be interesting, that I find to be of public, like, you know, it's good for public knowledge to have. It's like, hey, did you know this? And if you didn't, you know, here's the starting point. And most of the time I don't give people, like, because I don't know everything. So like my videos are not meant to be like all encompassing knowledge of like, oh, you watch my video, you understand the whole thing. It's a, hey, this is where I am right now. And then there's other resources, and go out there. If you're interested in this particular topic, you know, go find more of it. And that's, you know, that's kind of the journey where I'm at, and we'll see where it takes me.
I love it. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm excited to share you with my audience, and I'm really excited to follow your work and your journey. I think it's very important work. So thank you for doing what you're doing, and I'm gonna stay
Yeah,
tuned.
I'm so happy like we crossed paths and
Me
we're able
too.
to like connect beyond that just that one conversation that we had in DC. This is it was it's pretty cool. It's like one of the first things or one of the first times that this happening where like, oh, you meet somebody and you're like, oh, okay, let's continue to talk and just like out of a random chance scenario.
Yeah, I love it. We can definitely collaborate in the future. I think it'd be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because like I said, I'm on I do like segments, conversation segments on Breaking Points as well. Oh, that's the last part. I'm also on Breaking
Oh,
Points.
yes.
I contribute segments to them once every couple of weeks. And I usually try to bring some kind of perspective that people don't have. It's kind of supplementing the topical news that they cover every day. So, love to dive, I think you'd be potentially a very awesome guest to
Let's
talk
do
about
it.
like,
I'd love it.
yeah, let's do it. Yeah. So I'm sure we'll be talking again not too long from now, I'm sure.
All right, sounds good. Well, have a great day. Thank you so much again for your time. I know we went a little bit longer than we initially intended, but I really
It
appreciate
was
your
good. Yeah,
generosity of your time.
it was a good conversation. So it didn't feel right to put a pause. I was like, all right, I'll get to the other thing when I get to it.
Well, I appreciate that, and
Yeah,
we'll
thanks,
talk soon.
Alexis.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Bye.